This week on The Vergecast, Casey Newton joins us to talk about the lives of YouTube moderators. We go deep on the new plan to combine smart home standards and why the Z-Wave Alliance was left out. And we talk about the Xbox Series X that's coming up now on The Vergecast.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello and welcome to the Vergecast, the flagship podcast of the Vox Media Empire. Can I tell you a story? Let's start with a story. I saw Kara Swisher at a party. The company was having a little party. I saw Kara and someone was like, "Hey, Kara, do you know that Neil Hines says the Vergecast is the flagship podcast of Vox Media?" And she was like, "What?" And I was like, "Oh, God." And she's like, "That's okay. I have the podcast of the year."
Whoa.
It was great. It was like a perfect Kara
moment.
She's like, "You can have that. I don't need it." Because Rico Decode was Adweek's podcast of the year. Anyway, I'm your friend, Neil. Paul Miller is here.
Hello.
Dieter Bone is here.
Howdy.
And we have a special guest, Casey Newton, is here.
Hello, my friends.
How's it going?
It's great. And I want to thank everyone who reached out to me after my controversial opinions about Cybertruck on the episode where Neil was not with us, asking me to return to share more spicy thoughts. So thank you for having me.
Colin Letcher and I interviewed Ann Milgram. That episode will come out, but we interviewed her. She's a former attorney general of New York. We interviewed her about data and policing. And she came in and sat down and said, "I love the Vergecast. I just want to talk about the Cybertruck." I was like, I don't think we should, but I think kind of want to do an hour of Cybertruck conversation with the former Attorney General of New Jersey.
I have a lot of Cybertruck podcast related ideas for 2020 that we should talk about offline.
Is it a podcast called Cybertruck?
I said we'll talk about it offline.
All right, fine. Let's not give it away. Anyway, this is a special episode in the sense that it is our last episode of 2019. We're taking a break for the holidays. I hope you get some rest. You spend some time with your loved ones. Stop thinking about USB-C connectors or whatever it is you do when we're on the air. You're going to think about USB-C connectors because you're going to get a present for the holidays from someone you love. You're going to open the thing, and it's going to be micro USB, and you're going to want to swear. And when that happens, don't take it out on your loved ones. Just tweet
Go
at Dieter.
Go out to your car and send it.
Just scream in your car alone. and then tweet at Dieter. Just send Dieter a photo of every micro USB gadget you get. He's at back.
Oh, my God.
It's going to be great.
Actually, please do this. This would be great.
So, Casey, I would say that you have had quite a run this year in 2019. So it's fitting that you're with us to cap off the show for the year.
Thank you.
You have been reporting on the lives of content moderators at various companies. A lot of them talk to you. This week, you published a huge feature on the lives of Google and YouTube moderators. You want to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah. So I wrote two stories earlier this year that were about the lives of Facebook moderators. One was about a group of folks in Phoenix, Arizona, and then the second one was about folks in Tampa, Florida. And after I wrote those stories, people contacted me who were moderators for YouTube and Google, and they said, we've experienced some similar issues, and we'd like to talk about them. And so I spent 5 months, talked to 18 people, traveled to D.C., traveled to Austin, Texas a couple times, and we published a story on Monday that examines one key aspect of this issue, which is that at Google, there is a different standard of care based on whether you are a full-time employee or a contractor. And the full-time employee that we talked to is this incredible woman named Daisy Soderberg Rivkin, who was a content moderator for Google from 2015 to 2017, working on what they call their legal removals team. Her job was to remove stuff from Google search that didn't belong there. She wound up seeing a lot of terrorism and child exploitation. And at the end of that process, process. She was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that she continues to struggle with to this day, 2 years after she left the company. We also talked to this group of moderators in Austin, Texas, who are mostly low-paid immigrants, who are also suffering from severe mental health issues in some cases, but they don't have access to the same level of care. Daisy was able to take 6 months of paid leave, and the folks I spoke with in Austin don't get anything like that. And so it's kind of a story about how, on one hand, no matter how much you're paid, you're going to have significant mental health consequences, or at least some portion of Google's content moderators, you know, will suffer. But it's also about how there's a caste system inside these companies. And based on these rather arbitrary distinctions of whether you're full-time or a contractor, your life is going to be very, very different. And so my hope with this story was that we would illuminate that a little bit and kind of start a conversation about it.
So the first story you did, the trauma floor, we had you on, we talked about it, and I remember very clearly so much of our conversation was, these are basically the cops and firefighters, the internet, and we valorize cops and firefighters in real society, and we have parades, and there's like days of service. Like, we pay a lot of attention to these folks, and we honor them all the time, and the people who are doing it on the internet are horribly mistreated. Facebook was employing a company called Cognizant at that time. They were their contractors. And I remember one very clear takeaway from that first conversation was, you were like, just pay them more. Pay them more money. Treat them like employees. And so now we come to this story, and we have an employee who did make quite a bit of money, was an employee of Google, had all the benefits, and it still didn't like help. And I'm wondering if your kind of thought process there has changed at all.
It really did. You know, after I wrote the first two stories, the whole time I was reporting them, one of the questions in my mind was, how do we make this work better, easier, more just? And the obvious thing to do was just to pay folks better, right? Like, in Arizona, they were making $28,000 a year, and it just seemed so obvious that that wasn't enough given the risks that they were taking with their mental health. But then I talked to somebody who was making good money. People on the legal removals team were making $75,000 when Daisy started. She was able to afford a private psychiatrist, right? So she had all these benefits. And at the same time, like, it didn't save her. And so I think we need to start talking about some other potential solutions. One of the things that has been brought to my attention actually since we published the story Monday is that there's this quasi-governmental agency called the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And they run a hotline. And so if you see like child abuse imagery anywhere on the web, you can report it to NCMEC, as it's called, and they will investigate it and sort of work with law enforcement to bring the perpetrators to justice. Someone told me this week that the folks who staff that tip line are limited to a year on the job because they do not want to expose those people to abuse for more than a year. And then someone else brought to my attention that Google, in its early days of hiring content moderators, also limited moderators who are working on these issues to a year on the job. So there actually was a time at Google itself where there were essentially lifetime caps on the amount of disturbing content you could be exposed to, and those disappeared over time. And I think we need to move back to that place, you know, as sort of one of many strategies that I think would be more effective than my initial idea, which had, you know, just been a raise. Although, to be clear, I still think all these people deserve a raise.
Yeah, I think there's just the sense that they were just not getting paid very much money. So, like, what's the first thing you can do? And then you find the people who have the benefits and who are getting paid significantly more, and it's still not enough. And maybe it's limiting the amount of total exposure you can have. It's some of these tools that Google is building that you wrote about, where you look at the videos in grayscale. That seems like the most Google approach to it.
100%.
The most technological approach to it. Like, it's 41 shades of blue for the search box button, and it's like grayscale horrific videos for the moderators. But there's got to be other solutions. Like, the reason that they couldn't just do a year is because of their scale, right? I mean, the scale is like driving much of the problem, as far as I can tell.
Right. There are also not really career paths for content moderators. Like, this is something that I keep thinking about. You know, another, you know, in journalism, for example, your first job probably isn't going to be your best job. Maybe you're writing about a subject that's not that interesting to you because that's what you got assigned. But, you know, you prove yourself, eventually you get a better assignment. In content moderation, there's not really anything like that. And I'm told so often by these contractors at every single company that their workplaces are rife with favoritism, nepotism. The managers sort of only promote their friends. It feels like it's impossible to get ahead. Of course, you know, the Googles and Facebooks of the world are not really paying a lot of attention to issues these, like, you know, workplace favoritism among their vendors. And so you just get a lot of people who feel stuck. And I think that if you put a one-year cap on maybe moderating child abuse content, but then you were able to transfer that person to moderating spam or something that was a little bit less hard on the eyes and on the psyche, and then maybe provide them a pathway up into management or policy roles, this could start to feel like an okay career. And even if your first year on the job was really, really rough, there would be sort of a brighter future ahead.
I mean, I've heard so many people respond to your work by saying every executive should do this. And I can't help but like connect that dot to if everyone at Google spent their first year looking at the most horrific stuff that was uploaded to Google, like maybe the tools would be different. Maybe the system would be different because it still doesn't seem like those – like YouTube is still not architected to stop it before it happens. Like this is still a reactive process that's occurring.
Yeah, it's really true. And yet like – If you believe, as I do, that some percentage of people who do content moderation will develop PTSD, nightmares, a lot of really serious issues as a result of doing this work, do we actually want to encourage every Googler to have to do this? Like, I don't think we do. I don't want the executives of Google to all go out and get PTSD, right? I want them to find solutions so that none of them have to do it. Now, I do think that they would be well served to spend more time with those folks and to listen to their concerns. And yes, like a lot of them should be taking shifts in there and really understanding that issue. But, you know, if you're talking about, I don't know, like lead paint or asbestos in the walls or something, like I wouldn't say like, oh, well, like, you know, the landlord ought to, you know, sleep there for a week. It's like, no, like fix the lead paint in the walls. Like that's the solution.
Well, have you come up in the course of this reporting, have you come up with anyone who has an idea for a broader solution than sort of individual management tweaks for these folks?
It's going to have to be a basket of solutions, right? I do think that machine learning will help over time. Ultimately, there's only so many ways to murder someone. there's only, you know, so many sex acts. And I think we're going to be able to develop machine learning tools that detect those better over time and removes more of them without having them to hit moderators' eyeballs. But, you know, the moderators I speak with say that, you know, they think that is many years away, given the very difficult judgment calls, you know, that they need to make. In the meantime, what else can they do? You know, honestly, just spending more time with these moderators and asking them directly. Every person I've ever talked to has a lot of really good ideas. You know, for many of them, the issues have as much to do with the workplace itself as it does with the content, right? It's like, as we wrote about in Florida and in Arizona, it's like there's only one bathroom. I don't have enough break time to use the restroom. Or in Austin, it was, I have all these two-factor logins that I have to do, but I have to keep my phone in a locker. So I have to run from my locker back to my desk like multiple times a day entering codes, right? Just like these sort of ridiculous things that you know no Google engineer would ever put up with for more than a minute, but is the daily life for the people who are in many ways enabling their job. So that's where I'd like to see them pay some attention. And I think that there are ways that they could improve the workplace conditions that would, you know, make life easier on them.
So I want to ask about two very specific parts of the story. One's a little more inside baseball than the other. But the first one is, and I had not really considered this, Daisy worked on search, not on YouTube.
Yep.
What is the – and I don't think people think of search as having a moderation problem. How did that go?
Well, yeah. I mean, you may not realize that links are removed from Google search, right? We sort of think of, you know, Google has everything. It has the entire web. But there are a lot of countries, particularly outside the United States, that have banned certain forms of content, right? So like Europe has a right to be forgotten law where, you know, you can commit a crime and eventually, you know, you can have your web results scraped from Google. So somebody has to go in there and remove that. And that is a legal requirement. There are also laws around terrorism. And if someone has posted terrorist propaganda, you know, France has decreed that that has to be removed within 24 hours of it being reported. And so that was Daisy's actual job. If the French law enforcement reported something saying this needs to be taken down, she had to get in there, evaluate it, look at it, compare it to policies, and then decide, you know, is this maybe newsworthy content? Is this a news report, in which case we're going to try to leave it up? You know, or is it just, you know, an ISIS propaganda video, in which case it would come down.
And where were those videos hosted? That's
on web pages.
On web pages. So the French government would like find an embedded video on a custom player hosted on some French website, and Daisy would remove it from search.
That's right.
But she wasn't deleting it from the web.
That's right.
That is such a nuanced problem, right? I don't think people think about search in that way. I think probably most people listening to this are familiar with like the DMCA notice on the bottom of some search pages. But the idea that the French government is reporting web pages that have terrorist content and then someone has to like watch it and make a call seems so far out of how Google even promotes itself.
Right. And you know, the way that Google promoted the job to Daisy was you're here to, as a defender of free speech. Like you're actually here to fight back against these requests. Because remember, before 2016, most of the conversations that we were having about content moderation on the web was about times where platforms took something down that we thought should stay up, right? It was, you know, footage of the Arab Spring where people died and, you know, YouTube took it down and we got outraged because it was newsworthy. Or Facebook took down a photo of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and we got outraged because it's a newsworthy photo. So they all built up these legal apparatuses that were designed to keep stuff up on the web. And that was still how Daisy was sold her job in 2015. And what we've seen since 2016 is that the pendulum has swung and we are now firmly in the take it down era of content moderation where people just want stuff to be taken down from the web.
What do you think, besides the obvious election of Donald Trump that happened in 2016, like in the Cambridge Analytica, you bear some responsibility news cycle that has consumed in particular like your life since then, what has changed? Is there something that has really changed to drive that?
I think that the press finally woke up to the unintended consequences of social networks, but that was also in response to the rise of right-wing authoritarianism and fascism around the world. These companies no longer could credibly say that they had enabled the sort of progressive world that they told us that they were building for us. And every time a journalist would run a keyword search in a box, they would find something that wasn't supposed to belong there, right? So a lot of it was just kind of once we realized that we could start calling tech companies out on this, that they weren't going to have any good answers and they were going to have to go back to the drawing board and figure out what to do.
So the other thing I wanted to ask about very specifically is your first two stories about Facebook. Facebook employed a contractor named Cognizant, which after your stories exited the business of content moderation, just couldn't take the heat of Casey Newton. But Facebook engaged with you. They let you talk to their executives. They brought you into the facilities. They surprisingly let us take photos of the facilities. They were like in it, right? And the story was still critical of their efforts and what it was doing to people. But Facebook, to their credit, let you in the door. Google did not, as far as I can tell. I mean, I read the piece before it published, and I asked you, so I know. but Google did not engage in that same way. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, the sense that I got from them was they couldn't see the upside in it. You know, like they had read the Facebook stories, and I think they thought, well, what did Facebook get out of that? Now, you know, I would say that Facebook got a lot out of that. We really did hear their perspective and added, you know, like more than 1,000 words to the story where they just kind of explained their point of view. And, you know, I would have loved to have done that with Google. For whatever reason, they decided that wasn't a risk they wanted to take. I think that's a shame. You know, I think that these people are working in quasi public service jobs and, you know, arguably people have a right to maybe not know the names and addresses because we know that people on the internet will, you know, harass and threaten them. But there needs to be some way of us having a better understanding of, you know, who it is that's cleaning up the internet for us.
Google has a different contract, right? It's Accenture.
Yeah, and I mean, Google has multiple contracts with lots of, you know, big. It's like this industry is called BPO, business process outsourcing. So Accenture is. I know. Well, there. I know. I didn't put it in the story, but I know some people like lingo. So I'm just, you know, sharing a little lingo with you. So Accenture and Cognizant are two of the big BPO firms, and there's, you know, probably like a half dozen more really big ones. And you know, it seems like they have contracts with most of them.
So the thing about the BPO industry. Which I'm now very familiar with. but the reason that you hire consultants is because they're better at something than you, right? That's why these companies – that's why – I'm not saying it's true. I'm saying that's like usually the business logic, right? Like you're a small company. You're not going to hire the world's best accountants. You presume that Accenture has a lot of great accountants. You're going to hire Accenture to come in and audit you. That's the logic of the consulting industry. They don't seem to be good at this when it comes to content moderation. And that seems surprising as hell to me.
Well, I mean, my strong sense is that what happened is in 2016, Facebook and Google and others started going around and said, hey, here's a $200 million contract to come clean up our internet. And companies like Accenture and Cognizant said, you know what? For $200 million, I bet we could figure it out, right? we've done customer service before. We know how to manage a queue of tickets. Like, we'll do it. You know, Facebook in particular would also say, look, they could find moderators in places where we weren't, right? Like, we didn't have, like, you know, 300 speakers of the Sri Lankan language, right? But one of these BPO firms could find those for us. But I talked to another Facebook executive who just called these BPO firms body shops. And, like, their core competency is really just finding bodies to put in seats, which, you know, the title of our second story wound up just being bodies in seats after one person described themselves to me that way. It's like, that's all we are to them is bodies in seats.
I mean, isn't one of the other motivations here that these companies hadn't been hiring up the appropriate number of moderators directly from the jump? And so when they suddenly realized they needed it, they just had to get as many humans as possible, as quickly as possible. And it was way faster to just outsource that problem.
Yeah, faster and, of course, way cheaper, right? Like, a big theme of my stories has been how little these people are paid. And it's usually a fraction of what the tech company employees are paid.
Right. And if they actually did employ all these people at those rates, they would bring down their, like, recruiting statistics of, like, the average salary of a Facebook employee.
By hiring lots of bodies, you're sort of admitting defeat that you don't have technological improvements to this process, right?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, every time one of the executives has been asked about it, there's a reason why the first thing they go to is, like, well, you know, we're working on AI, right? Like, this is just, like, another case where it's the sort of magic AI wand gets waved as if that will solve everything. But we're just not that close.
They're, like, they're not dog fooding their AI.
I mean, they're working on it. It's, you know, like, Google Photos can pick out a lot of things if you search it, you know, if you do a keyword search. But it's just not perfect yet.
But does it even need to be perfect? I mean, the Google Photos example is a pretty good one. Google Photos will try. As a consumer, I see Google Photos try to do a lot of things every time I open the app. They're like, did you want this photo to be black and white except for this face? Like, I don't know. It's an idea I had. I'm a robot. Don't blame me. Like, right? Like, we made this movie that makes no sense. I think that stuff is great. As a consumer, it's great. It's fun. Like, I always look at it. It doesn't seem like they're willing to just try the same way they are with a consumer product or a consumer AI product. We see it across the industry. We've deployed machine learning. It's like a little half-assed, but maybe you'll like it. It doesn't – but like they're iterating. They're obviously building a bigger data set. There's certainly revenue potential, if not cost-cutting potential, when they do it on the consumer side or even particularly the enterprise side. There isn't any of that benefit on the content moderation side, right? That it doesn't make it better or even necessarily cheaper because it doesn't work well. Are they iterating enough there?
I think so. I mean, like, you know, one of the people I talked to this year who had the most, what he described to me as like the most boring job that he'd ever had and could ever imagine having was he would just look at thousands of ads every day and he would just have to say, is this political or not? The whole point of the exercise was to train AI to do that so that eventually, like, the AI could just flag, is this politics or not? And they have probably dozens of those projects around the world that are training what they call classifiers. And the classifier will eventually, you know, be able to do more of this work. One of the things that companies have started reporting now is how much of the bad stuff that they catch was caught automatically. And it's good, I think, that they are reporting that. It's like it's actually like a sort of a measurable demonstration of progress that they're now releasing. I can't remember if it's quarterly or twice a year. But they are making progress. And again, it's like where it gets tricky, and I think it's trickier at Facebook than at YouTube. At YouTube, like, one thing that I found was the policies don't change that much. Like, they tend to have a very kind of slowly evolving policy. At Facebook, every single day something was different. You could say this, you can't say this, you can post this, right? It was just constant confusion at Facebook over what you could do. And that's why the people I talked to at Facebook were actually really pessimistic about AI there, because it involves so many judgment calls. I'll give you one, like, example. This is like my favorite example. Girls at some point in the last year started using ho as a term of affection. And so they would go onto a friend's page and they would say, I freaking love this ho. And so these comments got reported and the moderators who were doing their job started removing them all because it was bullying, that you can't go on there and call a girl a hoe. And then at some point, there was outrage from all these girls. There was like, I was just trying to give my friend a compliment. And so then they had to reverse the decision. And so now you're allowed to say, I love this frickin' hoe. A machine is never going to figure that out.
Well, and what you said with the guy training, yes, this is political, and no, this isn't political. Like, that definition is going to change over time, too. Like any, like, thankfully, the definition of a dog and a cat is not dramatically, rapidly changing, and our classifiers are really good at picking them out.
I would say they're 85% at cat versus dog.
Yeah. Like,
some website every week runs a photo of, like, this photo of a cat destroyed an AI again today.
I can do you one better. When Google Photos was very early, I, like, slurped up all the photos I'd ever taken, which included some photos of Mark Zuckerberg I had taken when I'd been in the same room with him. And there were, like, they moved several of the Mark Zuckerberg photos and they associated them with my face.
No!
So, like, I am Mark Zuckerberg, according to, like, launch era Google Photos.
I accidentally once imported a bunch of LiveBlog photos into my Google Photos. Just by, it was, I should not have done it. It was an accident because I spray and pray during LiveBlogs. I take a million photos and post like 1% of them because I'm a bad photographer. Anyway, Google Photos just thought that Tim Cook was my best friend.
That's amazing. That's great. Did it make you a little video of like you and Tim through the years? That's perfect. So Casey, what happens next, both in sort of where you're thinking about where the reporting needs to go, because and we all want you to keep doing it. And then what happens next for these companies?
I don't know, man. Like, real talk, I sort of feel like I have told the story. It's not to say that there aren't more stories to tell, but I do think that we now understand what this industry looks like and what the lives of these folks are like. And there are a couple of more kind of turns of the screw I'm looking for. One is, I don't think Cognizant's going to be the last BPO company to get out of this business. I've heard whispers that another large one is looking to get out. So that's kind of something that I'm trying to chase down. We've got a class action lawsuit. We have multiple class action lawsuits that are now developing. There are some worker organizing that's been taking place, particularly abroad. All those things combined, I think, like, are also why Cognizant got out of the business. So as all of those things swirl, I do think this story is going to continue to be in the news. But I think with that kind of collective group of forces, we are maybe finally going to see some really positive changes. So fingers crossed for 2020.
Is this, do you think this is a change around the edges problem, or is it a, wow, we should not have done the call center model, we need to structurally rethink this whole thing?
I think there's a lot of debate about that inside companies. What I find is that the employees who are closest to this work thinks it needs the most amount of change, mm-hmm. which I think is really telling, right? It's like, it's usually the CFO that's like, you want to do what? you want to pay these people like we pay, you know, our PR execs? Like, no way, right? If you're really down talking to these people, you're like, oh, wow, like, you're basically a police officer and we're paying you $15 an hour. So, that's why I hope those are the voices that get really elevated and that companies pay more attention to them.
We had Alex Stamos on the show earlier this year. Alex Stamos is the former chief security officer of Facebook and Yahoo. He's now a professor at Stanford. And he was talking about there's like a market demand for this for the big platforms now, for companies to come in, actually develop the tools, use the economics of the software industry to have multiple customers at zero marginal cost, the whole thing. Are you seeing any of those companies starting to form?
I have been pitched by a handful of them. Frankly, I haven't had the time to dig in very deeply. It seems like, as with most AI projects, it seems like the companies that have the most data are in the best position to win. And so that is like Google and Facebook, because they already have millions and billions of images that they can process to kind of get a head start. But, you know, look, I think a world where Facebook figures this out and, really innovates with its AI and then is just able to release that as a commercial product, like, that's good. In a way, I'm rooting for these companies to develop those products and maybe take some of the burden of the very worst stuff off of human beings.
I'm of extremely mixed minds on this idea. Like, I think that's what should happen, right? Like, there's yawning demand for a better way to do this in the market at every level now. Someone should fill it. Great. Happy about that. Facebook commercializing its censorship engine is like, maybe not you, right? And then it's like, okay, and then once you hire the vendor to come and do it for you, you're still a little removed from the decision. And when you screw up at scale, you just blame the vendor and fire the vendor. And it's not your response. And like, it's a different set of trade-offs, like everything. Maybe it's a superior set of trade-offs, but I don't think that has been particularly evaluated yet either.
Yeah, I don't know that it has. Like that's definitely more in the realm of speculation. But yeah, I mean, the reason that I've been able to stay interested in it all year is because there are just so many tensions and trade-offs involved here. There's not a simple answer. You know, I had a guy write in to me this week to say, hey, Casey, has anybody ever proposed just banning YouTube? And then he's like, I know how crazy that sounds, but hear me out. And then there was like 40 paragraphs underneath, you know, where he like laid out his case. And the thing is, like, I am not a ban the social networks person. Like, I like Section 230. I don't think the internet would be better off if platforms had to moderate every post before they were published, right? It would get rid of so much of what we all sitting around this table would love the internet. But the point that I've been trying to drive home all year is you can think that and also want to take better care of the people who enable the internet that we love, you know, and start there as opposed to from this place of like, well, you know, let's ban YouTube.
I feel like there's like a hunger for the reinstallation of gatekeepers. And maybe it's because our institutions are crumbling around us every day. Like, there's a constitutional crisis unfolding as we speak. It's just a fact. And it seems like, well, what if we just had like Walter Cronkite again? And there's like one person and he was going to say all the news. And if you wanted some news, someone had to convince that guy who we all trusted together that this was the news. And I understand that nostalgia. I hear it from a lot of people. And I'm like, but the world was like objectively more boring back then.
The kind of opposite of that is it's sort of like the whitelist. Like, I don't have to have somebody, you know, go to my library and burn all of the books that would offend me. I just check out the ones I'm interested in. And like, Casey, I think you wrote a little bit about this as sort of a trend of the past year of the group being the social network.
The group chat.
Yeah, the group chat. So like Discord, like I trust my friends that, and I'm in different Discord group chats and I trust different ones, different amounts. But I, you know, the ones I'm in, I trust those people to not put something that I would find objectionable in front of me.
Yeah, I mean, I think like part of the solution to the internet is just don't put everyone in the same room.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter are places where everyone is in the same room and context has collapsed and everyone's miserable. And that's why Facebook is running as fast as it can to get us to all be in groups. That's why it's doing a Super Bowl ad I learned today that's all about having Chris Rock tell you to join groups. That's where they want to move it. You know, I will say my favorite like I don't know, like official is not the right word, but like maybe classic social network of 2019 has really been Reddit. And it's been because each subreddit sets its own rules. Like there's a floor where Reddit says, all right, well, you can't do these things. But like after that, you can set any rules you want for your subreddit. And what do you know? Those individual subreddits, they feel more cohesive. It feels like context has not collapsed. People get along a little bit better. And I just think that there's a lot that we can learn from that. And like, you know, by the way, if you went back 7 years and we said, well, at the end of the decade, we'll be talking about what a great job Reddit's doing at content moderation. That would sound crazy. But they sort of got there. So anyway, I think there's just like lessons that we can draw from that.
Can I tell you my favorite Reddit? My favorite subreddit?
Yeah.
It's wolves with watermelons. It's just photos of wolves eating watermelons because apparently wolves love watermelons. It's like a vibrant community. I don't even know how I found it. I just like spent like an entire night being like, there's a lot of people here.
My favorite part of Reddit is that it seems like every major subreddit that I enjoy has a spin-off subreddit that's a little too edgy for the main subreddit where it's like inside jokes and memes about the, I don't know, I just enjoy
it. All right, well, good job, Reddit.
Yeah.
Casey will be pointing his expose gun at you next. But good job, Casey, as well. Thank you for being with us, man.
Thank y'all.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to shatter the Z-Wave Alliance.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
We're back. I want to talk about smart home standards with you, the listener. It's
just nonstop.
I've been waiting for you to ask.
It's a lot. I mean, look, it's
all seems so boring.
We're going to make it exciting.
It is exciting. 5 years ago, we would write this article once every 6 months. The smart home is impossible to figure out. Nobody knows what's going on. Zigbee versus Z-Wave. It's all a mess. Cats and dogs. And we just got tired of writing it. We just stopped writing it because we just figured it would never get better. But now it's back.
Yeah.
Can you guys give me just a little bit of, because I don't own any smart home devices right now. I found an Echo. I have an Echo that is not, it's not plugged into anything.
That's the current status of most Echo Dots.
Like, I cleaned my room, but I actually just put everything into a duffel bag. And the Echo was in the duffel bag.
I will say that I have Google Home Minis just like still new in box, just strewn about my apartment. Because if you literally just sneeze in the vicinity of a premium Google product, they will send you a mini.
Yes. Oh, you got one because I subscribe to Fi. I got one because I have YouTube. Like, it's just like, here you go. If you signed up for the New York Times last year, they just like forgot and like sent you four.
Yeah.
So right now you're basically a HomeKit person through Apple products. Like Apple is your gateway to communicate with HomeKit compliant smart home stuff.
Of which there are three.
Okay. Or you're an Alexa person. That's probably the biggest one right now.
Yeah. Yep.
I guess you could be like an app person and control your Philips Hue lights directly through the app.
That's the most chaotic way to live, right? Yeah. Is like, I have a screen of apps on my phone, each for every individual smart light bulb that I bought from a slightly different company.
Yeah.
You're a monster.
The news here is that Apple and Google and Amazon and Samsung SmartThings and Zigbee, which also includes things like IKEA and apparently Z-Wave, all agreed.
No Z-Wave. Z-Wave's still out in the cold.
No. Z-Wave's parent company is part of the Zigbee Alliance.
That can't be true. I refuse to believe it. Anyway, whatever.
They all got together and they agreed, you know, we should figure out this whole way that smart home devices talk to each other. The networking should be standardized and it should use IP, the internet protocol. And so every gadget should have an IP address, and that is how you can address it because we know how to secure that thing. And in principle, a year from now in late 2020, we're going to propose a spec for how smart home gadgets should, you know, work at a base networking level. That is the news.
Super exciting. They've announced a plan to propose a specification. Can I tell you what, Paul, to connect it to what you were saying, these companies all think of smart home stuff wildly different ways, which led them to build their individual standards wildly differently. So for Amazon, Alexa is effectively its operating system. It's Windows. So Alexa is the most capable. It can connect to things the most ways. So Alexa devices, like the Echo Plus has a Zigbee radio in it, right? But yep. There's also Alexa Cast, so it can like directly control a speaker. You can also do the bad, insecure way, which most things work, which is you talk to an Alexa, Amazon's cloud talks to iHome's cloud, and your light turns on.
Yeah, the smart device connects over 2.4 gigahertz to your home network, and then it talks to the internet, which talks to your device.
Yep. Yeah, I would characterize Amazon as working with the most things, in part because of the three big platforms we're going to talk about, and we're going to completely ignore smart things because that's what everybody else does. of the three big platforms we're going to talk about, Alexa is by far, I guess I could say, like the most willing to work with the most things and the least concerned about privacy or locking things down.
Echo devices can also control things locally, which is sort of like under-remarked upon. But you can pair like smart switches and lights and stuff on your local network, and it will control them locally in a variety of different ways. And again, I think this is because Amazon sees Alexa as this operating system. So they just want it in your house. They just want it to be the most capable thing that the most things support, and they will just open the door to anyone in any way. Amazon.
Yep.
Apple, which yesterday Dan yelled at me when I said Apple was ahead of Google in this space. But there's a reason I make this claim. Apple has all the phones, right? Like that control center. They don't have all the devices, but it is true that they have like all of the phones of the people who might blow money on smart home stuff.
In America,
fine. Well, that's where I live.
I think you're.
Just go with me on it. I'm not saying Dan's the HomeKit is a success. I'm not saying whatever. Okay. I'm saying Apple has the phones.
I'm going at that.
But I think if you're the person who's going to buy 800 smart light switches, it is very likely that you have an iPhone. That's what I'm saying.
But if you're the person that's going to buy one, it's just as likely you're going to have an Android phone. Like the point of this entire alliance is that the smart home is now here. The success of Alexa has meant that it's no longer a niche thing of a person who knows what Crestron is.
Yeah.
Everybody is going to have some random smart gadget in their house. And so it's no longer just an iPhone, rich person iPhone thing.
Sure. But I think Apple, this is more about mindsets of these companies. I think Apple, which had HomeKit and thought it was going to be a thing, and it has the HomeKit control center interface is important. They think of this stuff as iPhone accessories because Apple's entire mindset is that everything in the world is fundamentally an iPhone accessory.
Yep.
Right? Like that's just how they believe things are. So they're going to certify HomeKit devices with custom hardware. And if you want to talk to an iPhone, you got to pay the Apple tax, get an MFI badge, HomeKit. This is not a success for them. That's all I meant is like they've got a lot of phones and their whole world is what if we removed another port from this phone and charged you to connect to the phone. Google's like solidly in the middle.
Yep.
They have a clear point of view on how they want things to connect to Google Assistant. They've reset like works with Nest to be more secure. More things support Google Assistant. Obviously, the Google Assistant is more capable than Siri. It feels funny just even saying it out loud. Like I have to convince you of that. In many ways, it's more capable than Alexa in terms of retrieving information. It's like Cast integration with TVs, I think, is really good. But it doesn't have all the devices, and it certainly can't do all the things. My favorite one that I just drives you bonkers is like you can't set a Sonos speaker as the default speaker. You can just easily do that with Alexa because Amazon doesn't give a shit.
Yep.
Okay. So Alexa made the smart home happen. They want everything to connect to it. I'm confident that lots of iPhone customers want to have an Alexa device that works with their phone and like have an ecosystem of things that works. I think Amazon hears that. They care about their customers. Apple's like, nothing works with our dumb phone. That's how Tim Cook talks about the iPhone. we might as well join this like alliance because it'll let more things talk to us. And Google, I swear Google is just along for the ride because they're like, well, we have like four to five extra standards we invented that we can just like throw in the pot.
Yeah.
And like see what happens.
So the motivation for each of these companies is really fascinating because I've heard – so there's lots of things I've heard. Just because these companies have agreed in principle that the plumbing at a network level should be compatible doesn't mean that they believe anything above that layer of abstraction, that level of abstraction, should be compatible. So the thing that you just said, Neelai, is that iPhone owners want Alexa to work with their iPhone is nowhere near close to like being a kumbaya moment right now. The only kumbaya moment right now is I don't want my customers to have to worry about whether or not they need to buy a bridge for their light bulb. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want my customers to have to know whether or not there is a particular Zigbee chip inside their Echo Plus. I don't want my customers to have to know the difference between Zigbee and Z-Wave and Sidewalk and, you know, whatever else you want to throw in there. We just want everything at a very basic, do I see this device in the network? Can I connect to it and make a button appear in an app somewhere or make a voice command appear in an assistant somewhere happen? So it's about setup and like basic networking. I think it's very likely that these companies are going to continue to fight tooth and nail at those higher levels of abstraction. So I don't think that we're getting anywhere close to a world where Alexa and Siri are going to like talk to each other. In fact, Amazon tried to create that world and nobody signed on.
I've read this connectedhomeip.com website. That's really beautiful. I can't tell what it is. They talk about IP, right?
Yep.
Obviously, they have picked IP, the internet protocol, like the IP address as a fundamental aspect of their protocol. Like that is the key building block, the cornerstone of this.
Yep.
I don't know what this is though. Like, I don't know what they're building on top of it other than to say, because it sounds like we got all this code across all these repositories. We're going to contribute it. It's going to be open source and stuff like that.
Dieter's going to try, and then I'm going to try, and then you can judge who made more sense.
Yeah. So basically, right now, if you want to make a smart home thing, you end up having to make a choice of like not just like what the communication software will be, but also like what the specific hardware and radio and chip will be, because they're tied tightly together. And so they want to disaggregate those things. And one of the reasons I think Google's involved is because they basically picked something that looks and smells a lot like Thread, which is their standard. But Thread was a colossal failure in the space. No one cares about it except for the folks over at Eero. And even there, they haven't been able to convince anybody to use it. And so the idea is to separate out the networking software from the networking hardware and just – like getting everybody to agree to that in principle was like, it took a minute. And that's why this thing, you know, in some ways I think it was rushed out the door. Like if you go to that connected home over IP website and you hit escape, you get the Squarespace login.
That's great. So secure. Yeah. Everyone is super ready for these people to secure your homes.
just to clarify what you say, the physical versus the software layer, like IP works over Ethernet, works over Wi-Fi, it works over the backbone of the internet. I can address something on my local network and never leave my home over IP. And I can also, you know, hack into Dieter's computer.
Right. But so IP, we also know how to secure IP, right? We've gotten better at that. I talked to Charlie Kindle, who used to be over at Alexa. Now he's over at SnapAV, which merged with Control 4. You probably know Control 4 better. They're like a smart home integrator, right? They create another abstraction layer that makes it easier to like build a really like sophisticated smart home. And his take was, I actually didn't put this in the article. His take was like, look, this was basically all of the companies agreeing that like 15.4, which is one of these wireless standards, is like here to stay. It's like going to be one of the main ways that these devices communicate with each other, 802.15.4. And so that needed to get standardized. Everyone needed to stop fighting over that. And then they're also no longer fighting over how they're going to address and also secure all the devices that are on these networks.
Sure. And so, here's my riff on this. And I was texting with someone at one of these companies, and this was basically the argument, is the reason Zigbee, which is something we literally never talk about on the show, unless we're going to make fun of the Z-Wave Alliance, which I promise we're going to do shortly. It's super coming. Zigbee is like one of these classic smart home control protocols. It's been around for a long time. It runs over low power radios. If you're going to put devices all over your house, they can't draw a lot of power. They might have to run on batteries. You need like low power radio to happen in your house. Zigbee is a low power radio standard, but its network layer and its like control command layer are intertwined. So you take Zigbee and you split out the network layer and you make that IP, and then you take like the Zigbee control command layer and you make that the communication protocol. And then you extend it with all the other stuff everyone else is talking about. And then like the dream is that HomeKit goes from being this like integrated iPhone control system to like Apple certification program. Now, is Apple going to let that happen? Like, who the hell knows, right?
Yeah, that's so confusing about this website. Here's a paragraph. Who knows which hyper-optimistic member of this group wrote this paragraph and put it on Squarespace? But the project aims to improve the consumer experience, yada, yada, yada. We believe the protocol has the potential to be widely adopted, Amazon, Alexa, Google Assistant, Siri. If the working group succeeds with this goal, customers can be confident that their device of choice will work in their home and that they will be able to set up and control it with their preferred system. That sounds like a lot more than just, we're all going to do IP, right, guys?
Well, no, it's that command layer. It's the Zigbee layer. So like right now, you send a Zigbee command that's like, turn on the light. And that is the command and the like literally the network addressing part of it are like wrapped up in the same packet.
So I could just assume if I have hardware that can control one of these smart devices, it can control all of them, but I might need a different app to do it. Is that what you're thinking?
No, I'm thinking that like there's Wi-Fi in your house, right? And so you buy a Wi-Fi router and it what's Wi-Fi 25 or whatever we're on now, but it speaks the same flavor of Wi-Fi and it's on your local network. And then you buy a laptop and it speaks the same flavor of Wi-Fi. And if you want to like send a file to another laptop, the Wi-Fi network will just have it and you can send different kinds of commands across your network. So they're all in the same network. They're sending the same kinds of networking packets in the same standard. And then the command layer is standardized.
So it's if I want my laptop to talk to your laptop, I ask the network, hey, Paul's laptop over there? And the network says, yep, I see it. And then I say, send it this file. It says, yep, okay. And that's two separate commands. Right now in the smart home space with a lot of stuff, it's like, hey, Paul's laptop over there, send the command. It's like all one single thing. And so you need to separate those two things out to make it simpler for everything to work together. And you're right. In theory, the both of the control and the networking layer will be relatively standardized across all of these companies. But I don't know that I fully believe that's going to happen.
The dream is that you have an Alexa house, you go out and you buy any smart socket you want, and you plug it in, and it works.
Obviously, we have in the real world, we have IP, and that works. And there's HTTP, and there's Gopher. You know.
Yeah. Sure. So they're trying it. And I think they're trying it because A, Amazon is driving it, and B, if you're Apple and you need ecosystem size to work with your phones, this is a good choice. Standards are good in that sense. And if you're Google, you can like contribute a lot of tech, and you know, the CFO of Google can be like, yep, the Thread team contributed to our success today.
And right? They get their bonus for that quarter.
They're fine. and then, you know, if you're Samsung and you make smart things like you remember that you've made smart things. That's a big win for you.
Yeah.
And you're already selling hubs and that strategy didn't pay off, but like maybe it'll integrate everything anyway.
And if you're IKEA, you don't have to worry about this shit anymore because it's finally standardized and you can just hire any bog standard developer who knows how to do this shit and then go make a thing instead of having to reinvent the whole damn wheel again. Like yeah. That's actually the thing here. This is nice for consumers. Like see the sticker on the box that guarantees that it works. But what this is actually for is any developer that wants to make a thing will have an easier time making the thing and, most importantly, have an easier time making that thing that will stay secure. Because right now, if you're a developer, you need to support at a very, very, like almost to the metal level, a bunch of different standards. And nobody can be an expert in all of them. And so one of them is going to get a little shoddy and then you're going to make an insecure device.
The best way to think about it is Wi-Fi for like not Wi-Fi specifically, but a standard that lives along Wi-Fi as a local network device that uses lower power radios. And they're just going to standardize it there. And then, like, there's, like, you're still going to need custom apps, right? Like, if you buy a Hue light system and it can do 45 different colors, like, that's not going to get built into the Amazon voice command system at, like, a native level. You're still going to need to, like, put the stuff on the top next to it in an app somewhere.
Right. Now, the good news, bad news before we get to Z-Wave, and this is going to lead us there, is this protocol, this whole proposal is meant to be agnostic to the like the communication system. So it can work over Bluetooth. It can work over Bluetooth LE. It can work over Wi-Fi. It can work over the, you know, the Zigbee band thing, the 802.15 thing, the 15.4 thing. You know, but that's all that they're saying they'll support right now, like basically those four or five things. They've said nothing about working over longer range things like Amazon's wackadoo sidewalk thing that they proposed, or Z-Wave.
Oh, you got there. Okay. Here's what we've learned about the Z-Wave Alliance in the past 24 hours. Here's the latest intel on this. So they announced this thing. It's like literally everybody in the world is part of it. I didn't realize Z-Wave's parent company was part of it. Whatever. Where's Z-Wave? Like, it's the other smart home standard. It's out. Our buddy Chris Grant has a house full of Z-Wave shit.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, sure does.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's like just not involved in it. Where are you guys? Why did you when Amazon put out the Echo Plus? And they're like, we support Zigbee. It's like, what'd you do to piss off the Z-Wave Alliance? Turns out, Z-Wave Alliance, a lie.
Alliance.
It's very good, Dieter. He did it. Okay. It's a monopoly story.
So, like, the Z-Wave Alliance is like, if I said I'm an alliance, like the Paul Alliance?
Yeah, the Paul Alliance. Yeah. Their entire business model is that they have this spec, and you can use it, but you can only use it if you buy the chips from them. So it's not a standard. It's a totally integrated, like, monopoly wireless standard, and they flooded the market with a bunch of stuff that people bought, so you have to support it, and the only way you can support it is by buying their weird radio chip.
This is exactly how I operate in my personal life.
Yeah, you're like, you want a little bit of Paul? $20, you get the whole Paul or nothing at all.
Yep.
So yesterday, Choip, as Dieter is.
It's definitely just Chip, but I think calling it Choip is so much
connected
more fun.
Home over IP, Choip.
Yep. It's Project Choip.
Oh, yeah. Project Choip. When Actual Alliance announces itself in this rushed fashion, presumably to cut the Z-Wave Alliance off at the pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is the rush. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, CS is around the corner.
Yeah.
So you gotta get Choip out the door. I'm sure that Jeff Bezos called up Tim Cook and was like, look, I know where Sundar is right now, but Choip is happening. That's how they all talk to each other.
I don't want to muddy the waters, but the Zigbee Alliance is a member of this new alliance.
Yes, no, that's
correct. Zigbee is the core of the Choip.
Zigbee's actually running Choip. They're the ones that are administrating this whole project.
Zigbee, the administrator of Choip. That's a sentence you can say now as somebody who gives a shit about technology. Obviously. Okay, so then today, Z-Wave calls up Jake Castronakis.
Yes.
Jake was like, who the fuck are you? No, Z-Wave is abandoning its business model today.
Yep.
Competition, driving us forward. They're no longer going to bundle the standard with the chips. They're going to make the Z-Wave standard an actual, quote unquote, open standard. Now anybody can buy the chips because they're running scared.
Wow.
Yeah. So they're going to let anybody make a chip. Here's the best part about this article from Jake is once you've gotten through all of this understanding of the lie that is the Z-Wave Alliance and everything else, you can read the quotes from the executives, particularly a guy named Mitchell Klein, who's the executive director of the Z-Wave Alliance.
It's a Commandant Klein of the Z-Wave Alliance.
With regard to, like, not letting other companies make Z-Wave radios, he said, quote, I would acknowledge that seemed to have been the only objection I was always confronted with. And then later, when it comes time to, like, recognizing that this connected home over IP project exists and that its parent, Z-Wave's parent company, Silicon Labs, is part of the board of the Zigbee Alliance, Klein said, I think it's important to note that at Silicon Labs, we see the big picture.
Yeah. Which is a Choip is coming. You're going to get Choiped.
Wait for Choip.
Anyway, I am dying to speak to anyone from the Z-Wave Alliance. If you've been listening, just ignore everything we just said. Send me one of your executives. We're going to keep an eye on Choip.
Yeah. Actually, inside baseball. Typically, you know, these big companies, some of them will reply to your emails, some of them won't. Some of them will reply to your emails and then call you and then want to get an executive on the phone to talk to you right now. Oh, my God. This time, they're all like, please go see our press release.
Yeah.
Like, to a company, which is very interesting.
I think they know that their plan is to have a plan.
Yeah.
And that, like, there's going to be a meeting. Don't you want to be at that meeting? I guess no one ever really wants to be at a standards body meeting, but, like, don't you want to be at a meeting where, like, the Apple engineer rolls in and the Google engineer rolls in and the Amazon engineer, and then, like, they're a click and everyone knows that they're, like, the power center and like, the Zigbee guys are, like, trying to have a calm, cool discussion, and then someone starts screaming about 802.15.4. I got to get in that room.
And then the smart things person is like, no, we can't do this. I'm canceling this whole thing. And then the Amazon guy pounds the table and says, no, we don't have a Choip. We have to.
We don't have a Choip. The Samsung guy's like, yo, you want a Bixby demo? And everyone's like, no, at the same time. Actually, speaking of Bixby, I just want to point out our friend Marquez Brownlee tweeted today, it's been 497 days since the Samsung Galaxy Home was announced.
Oh, my God.
Which is incredible.
they even announced like a mini version of it before they released the regular one.
CS is coming. I'm really hoping they have them on display again.
Yeah.
Samsung will literally release anything.
Yeah.
Like anything. They're like, I don't know, here's a nuclear submarine, here's a washing machine, here's a folding phone that doesn't work.
Yeah. We would be remiss if we didn't talk, if in all this smart home talk, we didn't talk about Thomas Ricker's great feature on IKEA. I call it IKEA 2.0 and their giant shift towards serving the smart home as like with as much rigor as they make flat pack furniture. And they have done like important things in the smart home. They're like one of the companies that actually made LED bulbs cheap, and they're going in and they're making these shortcut buttons that are really great. They've already had this partnership with Sonos, and because they're IKEA and they're the first place you go to when you have an empty home, they have a good shot at being really powerful here, because while you're buying your smart from a terminal, you can also buy, you know, a smart light bulb.
Yeah. I think it's smart. I think it's, Ricker pointed out, they had like an early attempt with a TV that was a total failure.
Yeah.
And like they've like learned from it. I don't know that I buy the thesis that because the first set of smart things you buy are IKEA things, it will be an ecosystem. But I do buy the thesis that if you actually get to a place where there's a standard and then cheap IKEA things just like fit into the standard in a secure way, that will actually drive like really fast adoption of smart home tech everywhere. Like,
yep.
If your IKEA blinds work really well with your voice assistant and your phone, like a lot of people are going to buy IKEA blinds because they're so much cheaper than any other smart blinds I've ever seen. Like, I think it's that kind of turn that IKEA can do.
Yeah.
Anyway, you should go watch this video. It's really fun. It's also, I think, Ricker's first big video with us. And it is just a delight. Ricker is one of our founders, so it's wild that he has never made a video of this kind before, but you just gotta watch it. It's great. All right, we're gonna take a break. I'm honestly just like emotionally exhausted from the Z-Wave Alliance. So we're gonna take a break. We're gonna come back, and someone's gonna tell you about this extremely large Xbox.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, we're back. Paul, every week, you personally have been holding America together. I want to just point out the obvious, which is that America has not actually held itself together, despite your valiant efforts. But
right.
I respect it. So let's close out the year strong. Okay. Let's bring this nation some unity.
Every week, America, I do a segment called To Charge the Time, Do a Dongle Crime, and it's about this really cool but possibly criminal Apple Watch charger.
Oh, yes. I love this thing so much.
All right. So, okay. You know how you charge the Apple Pencil? You used to charge the Apple Pencil, and you still do if you have a Lightning iPad, where it just sticks straight out. And that's what I mean by a dongle crime. The best dongles, which are all fairly bad, are, you know, flexible. You know, anyways, so this is a charger that sticks straight out, but it's a wireless charger for your Apple Watch. So it wouldn't work if your iPad was laying down and you plug the charger in. I guess it could. You'd have to undo the latch. I don't know. It would look really silly, but it looks really silly like this, where it's you have it propped up and the iPad's in keyboard mode, then the charger's sticking out the side, but. Mentally, this is very bad. But if you look at it, it's kind of cool because you got your iPad and then a tiny little screen. It's kind of like, you know, when you have your big Mac and you put your iPad next to it as like a side display. This is the iPad version of that. And anyways.
I'm excited for this thing because I'm gonna plug it into Android phones and I'm going to charge my Apple Watch off of Android phones.
That's a dongle
crime. It's
going to
be super fun. Yeah.
I mean, why do you think it's a crime?
If you have a dongle that is rigid, you know, like charging your Apple Pencil or putting a wireless charging pad straight into your iPad, if you're just begging for it to get snapped off.
Oh, I thought it was a crime because it's unlicensed from Apple.
Oh, I don't know. No, I just think you're losing when you lose this much of the ergonomics of your device, I mean, this is really one of the big things I hate. Like, headphone dongles make it slightly harder to use your phone in your pocket because there's like a kind of a distance of unflexible material now in there. Anyways, you know what I mean?
Dongle, yeah, it's not Phil Schiller showing up to arrest you because you're charging your watch. Which he does personally now. I don't know if you know where this. All right. There's a chonky new Xbox from what I've gathered. It is huge. It's a tower, and it has the name Xbox Series X.
Actually, it's just Xbox. This one is the Series X, though.
Are you kidding me?
No, we're only calling it Xbox, but this one is the Series X. That's like the full.
So there will also be like a lower end Xbox that will just be called Xbox.
Well, it might be called Xbox Series something else.
Series.
Because there's the Xbox One X, but there's also the Xbox.
All right, we're going to talk about its internals and what it can do and its size, quite frankly. But I just want to go through the name real quick. So there once upon a time, there was the Xbox.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And that was an executive at Microsoft called Jay Allard made it. It's a Skunkworks project. It was like custom silicon Xbox.
Yep.
Then there was the Xbox 360.
The original sin.
Yeah. The original sin. Not the Xbox 2.
Greatest Xbox console of all time.
And they named it that because there was a PS2 and they wanted to be one more. Bigger than before, right?
Uh-huh. Well, wait, the Xbox competed against the PS2. So the Xbox 360 was going to be competing against a PlayStation 3.
Right. And so they couldn't have the 2 against the 3. Yeah.
And that was an Xbox that was all around you, from what I gather.
It was the 360 was for the red ring of death.
Yeah.
That's
so bad. Also, Jay Allard Skunkworks outside of Microsoft custom silicon project. Then there was the Xbox One, where Jay Allard then made the Microsoft Kin, which Joanna Stern reminded us all of this week, the worst phone ever made. Canceled before it was launched, the Microsoft Kin. Then he left Microsoft. Then the Xbox became part of Microsoft proper. They released the Xbox One. The original Xbox One was a VCR, literally contained every dream Microsoft had ever had about the living room in one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Heavily focused on the Kinect, had an entire TV experience next to it. Forgot to talk about video games, I would say, at the launch event. Just kind of left that out. Mostly about how you're going to navigate Netflix with your voice, with your Xbox. It was very confusing. We wrote a long feature about it. None of that worked. All those executives are gone. That's a true story.
And Xbox has never recovered from that mistake.
Has not recovered. But the Xbox One, importantly, left all that weird custom architecture, PC architecture. Just like the PS4, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all AMD stuff now.
It's all AMD PC architecture now. PS4, Xbox One, PC architecture, very similar. And then there was the Xbox One S, the Xbox One X.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The Xbox One smaller guy.
Like the one without the disk drive that I can't remember what it's called.
I forget what the Xbox One S diskless maybe. I forget what they call it.
Great names all for Microsoft. Yeah. Xbox One Professional Edition for workplaces. all right. So like the names just like spiraled into oblivion.
Yep.
Okay.
And now their solution.
Now their solution is to just call it Xbox again.
Series
X.
Have
a Series X and potentially in the future a Series less than X.
My main concern is, I mean, I am very concerned about this naming scheme for the console, but I also do not know what X denotes or even connotes.
Extreme. There's only one thing it connotes, extreme.
What about Windows 10X? What about the Surface Pro X? There's like other X's in the world.
X is Microsoft's Pro. It just means the more expensive one that you wish you'd bought.
But there's a Surface Pro X that's like, it's a Pro?
Yes, duh.
Okay.
It's the Surface Pro X. Pro X, is that the – that's not the ARM one. That's the split screen.
That is the ARM one.
That's the ARM one?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's a fancy term for this, but if we try to figure out what X stands for by looking at this device, we might learn something because it is not a console. It is it's a PC tower that is not as long as a typical PC tower.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like nothing so much as a Macintosh Quadra 700. For my OGs out there, that's exactly what it looks like, minus the little lines that Apple put on everything.
Yeah, there have been nonstop Photoshops of it. My favorite one is just, it is the size and shape of a fridge in a kitchen. And, like, you don't even see that it's a Photoshop until you, like, it's just a fridge in a kitchen. Oh.
That tweet, by the way, got written up by, like, the IB Times / Newsweek is real. incredible. They had to issue a correction. This is a real thing that happened. Okay. By the way, my other favorite thing about the size of it, and then we'll talk about what it can do.
Yeah.
Microsoft, in their PR, pointed out that you could use it vertically and horizontally. And I was like, yep. No one knows this. We should write a post. And Chaim very quickly wrote a post. You can use the Xbox Series X horizontally. And that was like our top post next to the launch post because this is so confusing.
Yep. But if you put it horizontally, it's still very tall. It's like two VCRs tall. Like, yeah. I think it looks absolutely gorgeous. I really like the aesthetic. Yep. I have no 100%. Idea. I have a lot of large-ish devices in my home entertainment system. I don't know where to put this one.
Have you thought about adding a Drobo? Because that is the choice you can now make with Microsoft.
It's like two GameCubes on top of each other, but bigger.
I love it. I love how unapologetic it is. I wrote an article that was titled "The Xbox Series X is the Cybertruck of Game Consoles," wow. And I will stand by that.
Strong.
Claim. Yep. They're just not. They're not sorry. It's great.
So, Paul, when it comes to questions of architecture and what chips can do, I turn to you, my friend. What can this thing do?
This can do about two Xbox One X's of graphical flops. Terrible flops. So this is kind of a confusion that we all knew that Sony and Microsoft were kind of setting themselves up for by creating the Pro or X versions of their consoles in the middle of the life cycle to get, you know, some 4K upscaling for games. That they were going to steal a little bit of the thunder of these new consoles, and that is true. So this system is about double the speed at like 12 teraflops. Now the CPU is going to be way faster, and so the big change with the Xbox One X was mostly GPU related, and then obviously there was a news cycle a few months back. You know, both the PS4. Well, by the way, the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox, like they're talking about the Series X. This is going to be the most powerful console, but in some sense, it's all about like Sony and Microsoft are using, as far as I know, pretty much the same AMD parts. So they're just going to going to depend on how well they can cool and overclock, and if they splurge for like a slightly, you know, better run of the chips and stuff. But, you know, the technological generation and the general provenance of the technology is pretty much the same. Really fast NVMe SSDs and fast modern RAM and Zen 2 AMD architecture for the CPU and a lot more GPU than we've had before in a console.
So why do you need this all locally is, I think, one of my big questions, right? Like, Dieter's been playing Stadia.
I have.
Microsoft has xCloud. Like, it seems like the answer to, oh, crap, this all might move to the cloud is, what if you had a PC tower next to your computer?
I mean, was it Borderlands 3 is coming to Stadia at 30 FPS? Like Google can't even run these games fast in the cloud. And then it streams. And then you have to have a perfect internet connection to get it a high bit rate. And you have the latency. Like, there are just so... And there are there's problems. It is not... I think it's at least as much of a lift to port to Stadia as it is to port to one of these consoles, especially given the fact that these consoles are so similar hardware-wise.
Yeah, here's what I'll say. I think Stadia, like, I have a perfect internet connection at home, and like, it still chops. And that's actually not the thing that makes me mad about Stadia. It's like all the other execution problems that they have. They can't ship a hunk of plastic and a spring to hold your phone on a controller. Like, what are you guys doing? But the reason, even if you trust that all of those cloud gaming latency bandwidth issues get solved, and I kind of do weirdly, what a console sitting in your living room does is it is a thing that you own that does what it says it's going to do in your home, the end. There's no questions about, what will the frame rate be on the server? There's no questions about the bandwidth or the latency. It is, I bought this thing, I bought this disc, I put this disc in this thing, and then it does what it says it's going to do. That's great. That also is its advantage over PC gaming, in my opinion, because it's like it here is the thing, and its job is to make games good, and that I don't have to think about anything else with it.
Right. It's an appliance.
Yeah.
It's just an appliance. It is mostly a PC.
I have an original Xbox One, and it's got like the fan and the power supply is loud.
Yeah.
And the disk drive is failing, and it's always been big and ugly, and it's, you know— And the hard drive feels so slow. And so there are tons of problems with it. But like in general, if you have an old console, they keep working. You know, if you have an Xbox 360, you put a game in the Xbox 360 and it has—
There's no chance that if you have an original Xbox 360, it still works.
There's a better chance that if you have an original Xbox One, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've had so many Xbox Ones die on me. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe Xbox should have brought it. You got a PS2 and Final Fantasy 12. You can have a great time.
Yeah.
I do think it's gotten tougher. Like now, like if you buy, I think we're in a weird spot with this transition. Like we're mostly digital distribution, but there still are game discs, and obviously the new Series X has a slot, it has a disk drive, so they are going to apparently be distributing games on a disk. But what you do nowadays is you distribute a game on a Blu-ray disk, and then you have like a 40 gigabyte download,
yeah,
day one patch, and it's really awful. And if you did do that patch, if you don't play the game for a month, there's like a mega download. And the fast SSD really solves a lot of like the load time stuff, which is going to be awesome, but it doesn't solve that, like the day one patch and the ongoing patches problem.
How much of that disk drive is just culturally a bunch of console gamers want the comfort of having a disk? And how much of it is somebody from GameSpot is bribing somebody at Microsoft?
I don't know, but like if you don't care about modern rosters, you can get Madden 2017 for like $3 at GameStop, you know?
Yeah.
And what is it on the Xbox? I don't even know, but on the Xbox
it's store. It's still like $60. Even Madden is like that has a whole grinder cards mode thing that you have to do. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Well, and on the PC, there's a big sort of sales culture on Steam where people wish list stuff on Steam. But you have this feeling like if I get something into my Steam library, that is going to be useful to me for a really long time. Whereas, yeah, if I keep on buying Xboxes, there's a chance that my library will be forward compatible, but it's not like a guarantee. So it feels a lot more like throwing money down the hole to buy a digital copy on a console than it does, for me at least, on a PC.
That's interesting, because Microsoft has made some like promises about backwards compatibility with this thing, right?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
As far as I know, they should both Sony and Microsoft should have no problems with backwards compatibility because the last generation was PC architecture and this is a PC architecture. So I'm sure there will be little things with the software. And I mean, that's kind of, again, it's interesting. Like these are more like a PC and that this is an upgraded way to play. Like just like the Xbox One X could play a lot of existing Xbox One games, but in new 4K mode, you know, I'm sure that it's going to be a similar, you know, selling point for the Series X or even for the, whatchamacallit, because there's also going to be kind of a lower res version that's not even as powerful as the Xbox One X for the new X. Man, it's real frustrating not having good words to refer to things by.
We just name them our own things. Like we should pick like, I don't know, like classic Chevy cars and just be like, this is the Chevelle.
Yeah.
This is the Nova. Mm-hmm. And this is the weird one that was a pickup truck, but a car. This is the El Camino.
There's going to be a 4K newest Xbox and there's going to be a 1080p newest Xbox is what it seems like to me.
All right. Do we know when this Xbox Series X is coming out and what it might cost?
Next year, who knows, right?
That's the answer I was going for.
I'm pretty sure it's next year. It's weird. Like, I don't even know if E3 matters anymore. I would typically, this is the sort of thing you would announce at E3, but that would be, yeah. So it's probably holiday next year, right? $5,000. Yeah. I mean, that was a big Microsoft. It was a big issue for them that they came out of the gate $100 more expensive than the PS4, and so I am certain. I can't be certain. I would bet that they won't make that mistake again. That's probably with this cheaper SKU. But the cheaper SKU could be the sort of thing where it's like, psh, for, you know, the $400 PS5 is more powerful than the, you know, the $350 newest Xbox 1080p.
I mean, that's almost certainly going to happen, especially like as the generations change and those old devices go on sale.
Mm.
And then you're going to be really stuck playing Madden 17 for $3. All right. That's it. That's our last Vergecast for the year. Thank you for listening to us all year. It has been a remarkable year of Verge stuff, and I appreciate it. We'll be back next year at CES. That's how we're starting this thing. It's going to just keep happening to us. Year after year, we begin the year in Las Vegas looking at humidifiers with Wi-Fi chips in them. I'm excited.
Yeah.
You can believe that. Super sincere. Yep. Thank you to Casey for being on the show. There was a time when I used to be really excited about going to CES. That time has passed. Thank you for Casey to being on the show. You can tweet at us. I'm at Reckless. Dieter's at Backlund. Paul's at Future Paul. Have happy holidays. Enjoy your families. We'll see you next year.
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
Paul.